Whilst outward appearances may be superficially masked by a fashionable social patina of the day, the underlying health of a society can be gauged by the collective state of its institutions and social mores, with an accuracy that Sherlock Holmes might have affirmed as not conclusive, but certainly suggestive. Consider, for example, the burgeoning of weight watching associations in the UK, the USA, and elsewhere in what we refer to as the Western world. Nothing wrong with that. Who am I to say I couldn't do with losing a few pounds myself? But compare and contrast with the numerous third world countries that, through diverse causes from drought to locusts, are perpetually on the brink of famine, and one is hard pushed to find any commensurate growth in slimming clubs. Or nail bars. And dare I include those catering for the vanities in alternatively tanning and bleaching intimate parts of the anatomy, etc., etc., etc. Well, I rest my case. And that case is, to express it crudely, the extent to which we are exercised by or actively in pursuit of matters that, to others, might be considered shallow, even inane, is conversely a reflection on the inherent strength of our society. No great risk of famine, no immediate threat of war, no sign of pestilence on the horizon. Until recently, that is. We can afford to indulge ourselves because, as former Premier Harold Macmillan told us in 1957, slightly paraphrased, you've never had it so good. Not to say we are bereft of ills and misfortunes. Far from it, they are there, albeit hidden by that patina that, once buffed away, may reveal a catalogue of discomfiture. It is how we address those ills that may promulgate our success in society's development, bearing in mind that progress should not be confused with a step in the forward direction. Key to this progress is the usage, and even more important, the accurate interpretation of language and its meaning. The current idiom, Black Lives Matter, is as curious as it is disquieting, since the logical implication of the statement itself is that at some prior point to the catechism, they did not. These three words alone suggest a discourse that is not only a damning critique of what has gone before, but which also raises future issues of relative values. Lessons will be learnt, is the usual platitude. Very little seems to change any time soon, appears to be the reality. Ah, who of my generation doesn't recall the I'm Back in Britain campaign of 1968? Hardly a direct comparison, but illustrative nonetheless. Aimed at boosting the British economy, it became a nationwide movement within a week. But interest quickly flagged amidst much embarrassment, and the campaign is now regarded as an iconic example of a failed attempt to transform British thinking. So, if any movement is to entertain hope of lasting impact, it must be commensurate with values, expectations, and realities by acting as both a reflector and conductor of a universally desirable set of objectives. It must also, and this is crucial, be delivered in such a way that the message received accurately represents the message sent. It is on this latter aspect that it must be both stated and interpreted correctly and consistently. In this regard, we have much to learn from philosophical deliberation, and there is one philosopher in particular who springs to mind in encapsulating its significance. There is a tale about the university scholar who was appraising a student and his PhD thesis. The assessor wasn't particularly enamoured by PhDs, considering them a USA import that had no place in UK academia, so was a trifle jaded from the start. His verdict ran along the lines of, "This thesis is a work of true genius." It also happens to satisfy the criteria for a PhD. The recipient of this glowing backhanded tribute was one Ludwig Joseph Johann Wittgenstein, 1889 to 1951, and the subject of the genius epithet was his remarkable Tractatus Logico Philosophicus, published in 1921. At the time of its publication, Wittgenstein concluded that the Tractatus had resolved all philosophical problems, and he retired from philosophy for many years until realizing he had more to offer. His subsequent philosophical investigations, in which he recanted many of his own earlier assertions in Tractatus, did not appear in print until 2 years after his death. At a mere 75 pages, Tractatus is considered one of the purest distillations of thought ever produced. An aim of the Tractatus is to reveal the relationship between language and the world, by which Wittgenstein argues that the logical structure of language provides the limits of meaning. A central tenet is his assertion, if my schoolboy German is up to it, Wovon man nicht sprechen kann, darüber muss man schweigen, which translates as, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. What does that mean? Well, facts and logic are exactly so and can be described. Anything beyond these, religion, ethics, aesthetics, the mystical, cannot be rashly discussed and instead require the invocation of feelings, emotions, or experiences. They are not of themselves nonsensical, but any statement about them must be, because they cannot be proved or disproved. This view was concurred by his mentor Bertrand Russell, who felt that since he could neither prove nor disprove the existence of God, he saw no need to even contemplate the question. Russell wrote the introduction to Tractatus before he and Wittgenstein developed differences of opinion and became mutually fractious. The limits of language, for Wittgenstein, are the limits of philosophy. Hence, without apparent hubris, he considered Tractatus to be the last word, and effectively said we should all pack up our bags and go home. Until he reconsidered. In a different life, as a much younger man, part of my daily routine involved presenting principles of accurate and unambiguous communication. Recall the days you played Chinese whispers in the school playground when send reinforcements, we're going to advance, magically became send three and fourpence, we're going to a dance, and the problem is self-evident. So, how to avoid? My introduction to Wittgenstein came as a breath of fresh air, and though I'm not alone in finding his works too challenging to tackle head-on, for anyone other than the most gifted student he's all but impenetrable, a heavily edited familiarisation with his basic paradigms, collated by those able to survive the scrum, has proved singularly illuminating. According to Wittgenstein, language works by words being translated in our brain, not by textual recognition, but in the form of pictures to which we can relate. The issue is how that picture may vary between the transmitter and the receiver. So, should I tell my other half that I've been chatting in the pub with a young lady, I would need to ensure that my entirely innocent exchanges with an office colleague I met there by chance were not misconceived as a clandestine meeting with a secret lover. Or, as we would say in the vernacular, quite literally, she might get the wrong picture. Indeed she might. Philosophical investigations marked a radical departure from the picture's interpretation, where Wittgenstein instead referred to games theory, in which he postulated that the mind translates aural input into a series of games we use or manipulate in order to translate the messages. So, if I were to say to my other half, don't worry, it'll all be okay tomorrow, that simply cannot fall within the game of deductions based on fact, since I cannot accurately predict what is going to happen tomorrow. What I'm instead playing is the game of reasonable expectations based on previous experiences, which is a completely different gambit, but with wildly different potential consequences. This is very much a volte-face from his earlier work, but such was his brilliance he claims adherence to both, and is still a major influence in contemporary philosophical debate. Check out YouTube for lectures by, say, A.C. Grayling or Julian Baggini, two modern masters of distilling esoteric academic postulates into digestible brain food, if ever there were, and take it from there. It's fascinating stuff. But it is most certainly not just for the aesthete or connoisseur, and we dismiss such considerations at our peril. Throughout history, conflicts have arisen over misunderstandings, Even the mythical Trojan War was essentially based on a dubious premise. Was Helen of Troy abducted, or did she elope? Wittgenstein alluded to weighty considerations that impinge mightily on our own existences. Of course black lives matter, but by what convoluted strands of warped historical imperatives did we arrive at a position of having to expressly state so? And wherein lie the inbuilt attributes that do not require us to remind ourselves that murder, theft, child abuse or violence are all wrong? Unlike our compliance with imposed constraints of, say, commercial regulations or taxation, we should be cognizant by dint of our collective humanity under common law when such as the willful taking of a life or the oppression of our fellow man are universal wrongs. In a democracy, the people vote for leaders to act by proxy on our behalf. They in turn create the parameters within which we express our views. And how fragile those parameters can be. Remind me, please, how are things in Hong Kong at the moment? Thus the need for a precision of thought that is underpinned by universal egalitarianism. There is another aspect that must be factored into our equations, and that is our predilection for opinions and bias which are changeable with time and may, unfortunately, spill over into a panoply of isms. Ingrained beliefs may be difficult to modify, despite the strongest counter-argument. They may be suppressed, only to re-emerge when the moment is propitious. As the aforementioned Harold Macmillan is reputed to have once remarked, when asked what was most likely to knock governments off course, "Events, dear boy, events." No one saw the coronavirus pandemic coming, and Brexit has, for the moment, taken a back seat. In the meantime, largely but not exclusively fueled by events beyond our shores, we are witnessing a period of civil unrest and widespread malcontent, some peaceful, others not so. One can but hope that by the time we recover some semblance of virus-free normality, this bubbling anger may have muted towards more considered dialogue in which it is acceptable to all that a productive line of address could be established by first levelling the table. I am not convinced there is a global movement for any section of society, be it based on colour, race, religion or sexuality, to be treated more favourably than any other. It is, I contend, more accurate to suggest they would simply all like to be treated the same, to partake in the same game, to be part of the same picture. And I cannot pass by the irony of my musings here being recorded as a podcast. For, as broadcaster Clive Anderson astutely observed during an interview with the Mail Online in 2011, radio is like TV, but the pictures are better. Ah, perhaps therein lies true acumen.